Welcome to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris. In this month's episode, the risk factors for rape. Is sexual assault indiscriminate or are some women at greater risk than others? Also this month, can a conservative fall for a liberal or is the bedroom a politics-free zone? And how exercising with the opposite sex bewilders your biochemistry. This is the August edition of the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast from oraclelab.co.uk. Sexual assault is often described as a crime of anger, but some evolutionary psychologists have suggested there may be other motivating factors for men who rape women. 11 years ago, Randy Thornhill and Craig Palmer published a controversial book that argued that rape may be a biological adaptation. In other words, men might rape because it gives them an evolutionary advantage. This is certainly the case in many non-human species. For example, male mallards commonly coerce females into copulating, especially if those males have previously failed to pair up with a mating partner. If men have also been shaped by evolution to use rape as a mating strategy, we might expect younger women to experience sexual assault more frequently than older women, because younger women have higher fertility. The logic goes that men are more likely to rape if their victims have a greater chance of falling pregnant. This month, Richard Felsen and Patrick Cundiff of Penn State University published a study in which they tested this very prediction. Using the National Incident-Based Reporting System, a crime database administered by the FBI, they checked whether the victims of over 34,000 robberies were also sexually assaulted. They looked at robberies because this controls for prior contact between the perpetrator and the victim. Felsen and Cundiff discovered that women are more likely to be sexually assaulted if they're between the ages of 20 and 24, which is also when fertility peaks. Women younger and older than this are much less likely to be sexually assaulted, and there's a strong drop-off in the likelihood of sexual assault once the victim is over 50, when most women are no longer able to become pregnant. This suggests that when men sexually assault, they're targeting women who are most likely to conceive. Or it could just be an opportunity effect. Women who are younger go out more, meet men more often, and are probably at greater risk of being assaulted for those reasons. Whichever way you look at it, it seems that age is a risk factor for rape. By coincidence, another research study on risk factors for rape was published this month. This study didn't look at women's age, but at their behaviour. I spoke with the lead researcher on this project, Karen Perilou of Williams College, Massachusetts, via a slightly shaky Skype line and began by asking her which aspect of female behaviour she'd investigated.
We looked at mating strategy, and in our study, we basically measured that by using the SOI, which is a measure of sociosexual orientation. Basically, the higher you score on it, the more you tend to adopt a short-term mating strategy where you're interested in multiple sexual encounters, you have one-night stands, you like to have sex without love, etc. And so our prediction was that women who engage, you know, that's their preferred mating strategy, well, first off, they're going to probably encounter, they're going to have more potential sexual encounters than women who aren't pursuing a short-term mating strategy, probably on average. But beyond that, there has been some work that shows that men who are also interested in short-term mating are also they also score higher in likelihood to sexually victimize. And so we thought, well, if these women who are oriented towards short-term mating are, you know, meeting up with and engaging in any kind of romantic or social interactions with, you know, men who are short-term maters, well, then they're not only having this higher base rate, but they're also meeting up with these men who are at a slightly higher likelihood of being victimizers themselves. So we thought, well, possibly if women are just pursuing this mating strategy, then maybe they're going to be more likely to be sexually victimized. And as the study showed, there does seem to be some sort of correlation there.
So as you say there does seem to be some relation between whether a woman has what we would call a high SOI score, a high sociosexuality, a propensity to engage generally in short-term relationships. There's a relationship between that and the likelihood that she will end up as the victim of a sexual assault.
Right. In our study, it's obviously quasi-experimental, so we can't really say causally what's going on. But we did find that, you know, women who were in, so we had various groups of women after we divided up the sample. We had women who had experienced a completed rape, women who experienced some sort of attempted victimization, and then women who had never experienced any of that. The non-victims. And so we found that the women in the completed group had higher SOI scores than women in the attempted group or the non-victims group.
So it turned out that the women who'd been the victim of a completed sexual assault were more likely to have this propensity to pursue short-term relationships. And that may or may not be causation relationship, but it could be that their sociosexuality has changed after the assault, and we can't be sure just yet?
We can't exactly say. As you've indicated, it could go either way, and there's evidence actually that it could go either way. So there's some evidence that women, after they experienced sexual victimization, suddenly start adopting this more casual sex type of strategy. But on the other hand, there's also evidence that some women do the opposite, and then they completely shut down and they don't have sex and they don't have romantic relationships for a long time afterwards. So it's not totally clear. The only other circumstantial evidence we had so far was that we also looked at what women self-reported as the kind of sexual experiences they engaged in with the victimizer before and after the assault. And in this sample, we found that, there was a trend. One was significant and the others were just trending, that basically women who were in the completed group were indicating having engaged in more intimate behaviors with their perpetrator before the perpetration occurred.
This is really interesting, because a lot of people have this idea of sexual assault and rape as happening between people who don't know each other. And yet, from your data, it shows here that a large proportion of people are having some consensual intimate contact with the victimizer before the assault. And is it right that it was something around 80% of women have some kind of consensual intimate contact, like kissing, before the assault? So people's ideas of who it is who ends up being raped or who ends up being a rapist might not tally with how things really kind of pan out in the real world.
Oh, you definitely hit the nail on the head. That is completely true. I mean, people's stereotypes of the rapist is this, creepy guy lurking in the shadows, some stranger who decides he's going to assault this beautiful woman walking by. Well, that's not really how it goes down. As you've indicated, other studies have also, shown this is overwhelmingly the victim knows the victimizer. And a lot of the times it's an actual either, most of the time I would say, at least in our study, it's someone that they're either currently mated to, they're going on a date with, so there's some romantic interest, or it's someone that they broke up with or was broken up with, so a previous mate. So not only do they know the perpetrator, oftentimes there's already been some sort of romantic context indicated.
And it's possible that the results of your study could help women to make safer choices and to put themselves at less risk of suffering a sexual assault. But I was wondering whether you think people are willing to receive this kind of advice right now. Obviously, I'm thinking of things like the slut walk protests that started up earlier this year, when a Toronto police officer suggested that women should dress less provocatively to avoid the risk of rape. So do you think people are kind of ready for this advice? Do you think it could be useful for people, or are people perhaps just going to be not wanting to hear this kind of thing?
Unfortunately, I think it's probably going to be people not wanting to hear this kind of thing, because again, there's that misconception that if you say, here's a risk factor for something like rape, then people immediately, have a backlash saying, oh, well, you're blaming the victim and it's not, they should get to do whatever they want. And that's absolutely true. Women should be able to wear whatever they want, say whatever they want to say, exactly. So the problem is not that, we're saying, okay, women should now do this. And that, I think, is the problem. So it shouldn't be something where you say, here's what you need to do now. It's saying, here's the risk factors. You decide for yourself what you want to do. It's just like, okay, I have a car, and I leave it on the side of the road with $1 million in it. And I leave all of the windows down, the doors unlocked, etc. If somebody steals it, are there any risk factors that I could have done to prevent that? Sure. But is it my fault that somebody decided to steal my money? Absolutely not, and that person will be punished. So it's just, I think it also has to do with the packaging. If you, say, here's what you need to do, you kind of put the, onus on them and say, here's what you need to do, and if you don't do it, well, then you're in trouble. Instead, it should be presented as more, here's all the information. You can, you're well-educated women, and you can make your own choice. You decide what you want to do.
The benefits of physical exercise are well documented, and recent research has shown that as little as 15 minutes of cardio a day increases life expectancy by 3 years. In contrast, the positive effects of exercise on your love life, specifically the effects of competitive sport, are less well known. Sex drive in both men and women is boosted by testosterone, and secretion of this hormone is particularly sensitive to competition. Most contests in nature are over access to mates, usually of the sex that's most choosy, and most of the time, that's females. The winners of the competition are better able to pick and choose their mating partners, or to monopolise a harem. This is true of any number of species, from stag beetles to, well, stags. And maybe humans too. People who are victorious in competition experience surges in testosterone. This effect isn't restricted to the winners of physical contests. In fact, it's also seen in winners of chess matches, and even in fans of winning wrestlers and football teams, whose hormone levels soar in response to their vicarious victory. If the effect of competition on hormone levels is all about priming us to reap the reproductive benefits of victory, we might expect to see bigger boosts in testosterone when the opportunities for mating are greater. In many non-human species, testosterone peaks during the breeding season, or during periods of social instability when competition for mates is strongest. Saul Miller and colleagues of Florida State University tested whether this was also true of humans. They recruited male and female competitors in an ultimate frisbee tournament. Before and after their matches, the competitors provided saliva samples that the researchers used to test their hormone levels. The change in testosterone over the course of the match would be a good measure of a competitor's motivation to seek a partner. And the measure of mating opportunity? The ratio of male to female spectators. Assuming the competitors were heterosexual, a large proportion of opposite-sex spectators on the sidelines might be a signal that potential partners are abundant. This seems to have been the case, because Miller found that the increase in testosterone levels was greater when the proportion of opposite-sex onlookers was high. Men's testosterone increased more when there were more women about, and women's testosterone spiked when there were more men in the vicinity. This suggests that when people compete in the presence of potential mates, their hormone systems react in such a way as to promote performance and the likelihood of securing a partner. Now that's what I call keeping your eye on the prize.
In a time of change, Aretha Gupta needs her own fresh start.
You should come volunteer for us.
She could be our new volunteer coordinator.
But when love drops in unexpectedly, it will come from the one place she never imagined.
You're the McCain volunteer coordinator?
You seem surprised.
Oh, Lord, if you had to suck face with a Republican, at least he's a cutie patootie.
I'm sure all the American listeners out there raced to their local multiplexes last week to be amongst the first to see Politics of Love, so you don't need me to read you the synopsis. Or maybe you do. Essentially, it's the story of a Democrat campaign volunteer who falls for her Republican opposite number. Now, it can't just be me who finds this premise slightly unfeasible. Can a right-winger and a liberal ever get it together? If Arnold Schwarzenegger and Maria Shriver are anything to go by, then yeah, they can get it together, but maybe they can't keep it together. But if we look at this a bit more scientifically, we look at the data, we find that after physical attractiveness and age, the characteristic on which most couples appear to match is that, well, they tend to agree on stuff. They have similar political opinions. So do we choose partners whose political opinions complement our own, or do we pair up along party lines by chance? Casey Klofstad of the University of Miami investigated this question by looking at profiles on a popular dating website. He found that almost 80% of people advertised their fondness for movies and dining out. Fair enough. Who doesn't like watching and or eating things? Around about 40% of people said they were into hunting or visiting museums or wine tasting. But only 14% gave away whether their politics were liberal or conservative. And to put that into perspective, that's fewer people than voluntarily describe their body type as heavy set. So it seems that we're quite cagey when it comes to letting on about which way we vote. Agreement over the best candidate might be important for long-term marital stability, but when it comes to seeking a partner out, most people choose to focus less on party politics than on indicators of sociability, how willing people are to leave their house for the cinema or restaurant. The fact that our political predilections match those of our long-term partners might be because we choose partners on the basis of traits that go hand in hand with political affiliation, such as education, income, and religiosity. Believe me when I say that this is the most depressing piece of news I've heard all year. It means that, at least in terms of scientific accuracy, Politics of Love is a better movie than Rise of the Planet of the Apes. That might actually be the most glowing review that film gets. Seriously, any of you out there with an internet connection, which, seeing as you're listening to a podcast, is all of you, go to the Apple Trailers site right now and look at the trailer for Politics of Love and tell me if you've ever seen a trailer for a worse rom-com. That's all for this episode. If you'd like to find out more about the research featured in today's show, head over to www.oraclelab.co.uk and click on podcasts. You can also keep up with new research throughout the month by following Oracle Lab on Twitter. Thank you to my interviewee, Karen Perilou, and thanks to you for listening to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. Until next time, I'm Rob Burris.